This week on Mac Break Weekly, Leo is away. Andy and Renee and Alex are here, and we are joined by Kelly Gamont of App Camp for Girls. We're going to be talking about Apple's earnings call. We're going to be talking about Mr. Tim goes to Washington for a state dinner. We're going to be talking about a MacBook keyboard that, despite our low expectations, is still leads our lower expectations. And we raise a glass as we say goodbye to one of our favorite Mac rumor mongers who goes on to greener pastures.
Netcasts you love.
From people you trust.
This is Twit.
Bandwidth for Mac Break Weekly is provided by CacheFly at CacheFly.com.
This is Mac Break Weekly, episode 608, recorded on May 1st, 2018. NPR took my dog.
Mac Break Weekly is brought to you by Tres Puntas, freshly roasted gourmet coffee shipped directly to you. Visit trespuntas.com/MacBreak and use the code MacBreak to save 20% off every bag of coffee in your subscription. And by Texture. Access the world's most popular magazines anytime, anywhere, using your smartphone or tablet. Go to texture.com/twit and start your free trial today.
It's time for Mac Break Weekly, the show where everything's made up and the points don't matter. I am Andy Anatko. I'm not Leo Laporte. I am wearing a tie. I'm cosplaying as a responsible adult because I am in the host chair right now. But I am backed up, fortunately, even better than the cosplay responsible adult tie. Other people who are going to make this show very, very good are, as usual, Renee Ritchie from iMore. Renee, how's it going?
I feel like I'm in the safest hands. Like I'm just being cradled in podcast excellence, and I can't hope it succeed, Alec, Andy.
Oh, you got the Andy Anatko guest host complimentary fleece that I sent to all the green rooms. That's good.
It's getting warmer, but it's not warm. How's that?
There you go. Also joining us as usual and as welcome is Alex Lindy from the Pixel Corps.
Hey, good to see you.
You're looking very outdoorsy. It's not just the stubble. It's also you've got the woodland sort of like I'm a lumberjack shirt on.
And no glasses.
I just got up this morning in a different mood. That's all I got to say. I felt like a lumberjack.
You look very Northern California. You got the glow about you that you know doesn't mean pregnancy, but it means that you've been forced to spend some time outside.
I have actually spent more than 10 minutes outside this week, so it's been good.
And welcoming back one of my favorite people to podcast with from App Camp for Girls, Kelly Gamont. Kelly, thank you for coming.
Hey, it's good to be here. It's going to be a lot of fun.
Well, we'll see about that, but it won't be if it's not fun, it won't be any of your fault. But we can only hope. We're definitely gonna be having a better time than Tim Cook will. Later after we record the show, Apple is gonna be having their second earnings call in which Tim explains what happened during the March quarter. Most of the stuff when you Google for this sort of term comes up with Apple is looming to have the worst quarter ever as iPhone 10 sales plummet into subterranean levels. They got some stuff they're going to have to be talking about. As of about an hour ago when I check, Apple stock is up 1.43%. There's some things that we're kind of worried about. The second quarter is generally not a barn burner. You're not getting the lift from the iPhone sales. But we have until the call comes, we have a whole bunch of analysts' predictions to look at. Wall Street Journal, probably quoting Gene Munster, I think here, is predicting $61 billion in March quarter revenue, or that would be 15% year-over-year growth, which would be about pretty much what Apple had predicted in the last call. Gene Munster, Loop Ventures, is one of the guys that one of the people that I look to for artificial intelligence on this. He thinks that Apple is going to forecast revenue between $48 and $51 billion for next quarter, and 18 to 20% growth for services, which, as he notes very clearly, is becoming really, really important as Apple tries to make sure that they're not just making money off of iPhones in the future. He's saying that the results are going to be about 3% down off of the street. Street predictions quoting that there's going to be about only a modest risk from negative comments that were in the press from two key iPhone suppliers, Taiwan Semiconductor and who creates CPUs, and AMS, who supplies 3D sensing modules. They are two key suppliers for the iPhone X, and both of them in their public comments had to say that, we had a major supplier not up their orders as much as we thought they would. They're also joining Samsung, who made similar comments about, again, a big customer of theirs for OLED screens, Cognex, which is a company that sells services and stuff to help people make exactly the iPhone X, the screen assembly services. They had their call on Monday, and they said that they're way, way down. So people are expecting not a whole lot of exciting news about the future of the iPhone X. Gene Munster, in his letter, did say that the company is a safe haven in terms of protecting user privacy, calling that out specifically. So it's hard to know what's going to happen. Renee, what do you think? What do you think Tim has to talk about? What do you think that we should be preparing ourselves for?
I mean, the biggest threat to Apple right now is the same that it's been for the last, many odd decades, and that is investors. Apple could literally make $1 trillion a day, and investors would say, why aren't you making $1.1 trillion tomorrow? Because they really are growth focused. And Apple, the PC business, which includes the Mac, is mature. The smartphone business, which includes the iPhone, is mature. And we're seeing all these doom and gloom articles, but when you actually read the articles, like, iPhone sales will be up, but smartphones are mature. Apple's made even more money off the iPhone X. They own 35% of revenue by smartphone, but it's too expensive and people hate it. Apple's going to be selling less phones this year. Well, I guess if you include iPhone 8 and iPhone 10, they're actually selling more phones, but we feel like saying they're selling less phones. But like, to Gene's point, services are perhaps the one thing that Wall Street is smitten with Apple, and they're doing good business on that. They're continually up on that, and there's rumors they're going to be adding texture-backed Apple News magazine subscriptions to that number. So if there is a rosy glow, it'll be that. But I think this is really a perception war, and given Wall Street, those are almost always impossible to win.
Yeah, that was another note that Gene Munster made specifically, mm-hmm. that he expects them to really be even further investing in other media, not just movies, not just TV, not just apps, but also what we used to call print publishing. And he was talking about texture, but also talking about other opportunities that they may have. He was also said something that I found kind of interesting because I'd never really seen it before. And again, this is once again. This is from Neil Seibert in his Above Avalon newsletter, different analyst, talking about what Apple is going for in these calls now. He says, and I quote, instead of iPhone sales or Apple services revenue gaining importance, Apple's balance sheet strategy is driving the company's new Wall Street narrative. So they're not trying to put the focus on here's how many iPhones we're selling, here's what Mac sales are doing or iPad sales are doing, but look at what we're doing with our money. We're being very, very smart with it. More boring numbers. The company repatriated $269 billion because of the tax holiday that Trump arranged for them. So they paid a discounted $38 billion lump sum in taxes to bring that money home. They would have otherwise had to spend $80 billion to bring that in. They also put $13 billion in escrow to fight the European Union tax dodge penalties that they're going to be fighting against. But they can't fight it until they put the money that they, quote, owe, unquote, in some place where they can't get at it. They also announced $30 billion in capital expenditures over the next 5 years, partly for the new campus for tech support. But you're right. I mean, these are I'm glad that I'm hosting this week, so I have the responsibility of rattling off the boring numbers instead of being the person who has to say, yes, but what does this mean to someone who's shopping for a new iPad? Kelly, is this just like inside baseball, or is this just some way to fill time for 20 minutes during a Mac break that tapes on the day of the call?
Well, partly I have to call shenanigans on this because it doesn't matter what numbers Apple comes out with, like Renee was saying. Somehow we've ended up with this third measurement system that we have. We have like imperial measurement, like we use here in the US, and then we have metric measurement, which the rest of the world uses. And then we have the one that whatever Apple says, it needs to be just this much more. Like there's this whole other set of measures that we use. If you took anything about any of these numbers that people are predicting for Apple and you find and replace Apple with Dell or Microsoft or Samsung, like those exact same investor advice sorts of people would be fainting over the amount of unmitigated success that we're seeing right now. And when Apple does it, it's just never quite good enough. And that's the part that I find sort of frustrating in listening to some of this analysis and in listening to some of the questions that they get at the end of the call is the kind of stuff, you know, where people are like, yeah, so you made $1 billion and you sold 4 iPhones a second for every second of the entire quarter. And, you know, really what we want to know is why you didn't sell 5 every second for the whole quarter. And it's hard to listen to that stuff because, like I said, if it was any other company coming up with these kinds of numbers, they would be considered an unqualified success. But when Apple does it, it's not enough. Or if they actually do a little bit better than they have said that they were going to do, then it's, well, how long can this last? Because clearly they can't continue to like be really successful. Like we just won't allow it, you know, is kind of how this comes out. And it's not a good look on anybody. And part of why I find it frustrating is because I want to know if this is the same thing in other industries. Like if it's not tech and people are looking for advice on stuff like this, like is there an Apple in a different field, you know, in healthcare or something that like whatever they do would be amazing if it was any other company. But because it's these guys, like it's never quite good enough because it seems like that's not the best kind of information to have.
Mm. Yeah, the Apple's difficulty, part of it is that they're famous for making a kajillion dollars off the iPhone, but they're also famous for making 61 to 62% of their money off of the success of the iPhone. So part of this has to be storytelling to say that, yes, if everybody forgets that they want a smartphone that's really, really super cool and they're willing to spend upwards of $1,000 for them sometimes, what does Apple have planned other than selling iPhones? Alex, as the CEO as the head of a wonderful company, like does Tim have to engage in a little bit of footwork, or can they just simply say, "Look, dudes, I mean, if you want to sell your stock, we're buying back, so we'll buy it from you if that's your problem."
Well, and most likely we'll see you buy back. I mean, you know, I think I think Apple usually tries to take advantage of any kind of stock softness in buying back stocks. This is probably a good time for them because the stock has been a little softer recently. So I would expect $50 to $100 billion of stock buybacks is announced today to use that. I personally think that dividends are a waste of time. I mean, I think that they should just do stock buybacks and continually pull that back in as opposed to just handing out free money. I think that Apple, if you have a really great phone, and I think the iPhone 10 is the best phone that I've used so far, and it's making more money, it doesn't really matter if it's selling, you know, the same number. If it's generating the same amount of revenue, I think that it, you know, from Apple's perspective, I mean, I think that the analysts can say, oh, no, everything's sliding. But that's also you have a clientele paying for that you probably can sell more services into than folks that are getting free phones. So it's a whole different, you know, really focusing on what makes them different as opposed to trying to just go after the mass number of phones probably makes sense for Apple, especially if you're trying to move into a service-based, you know, if you're trying to add services, what you want are the people that are most likely going to buy those services. And what makes Apple different is it's secure, it's stable. It's a good experience. Those are all things that are of a lot of value, I think, for Apple. And I think that it's better for them to focus on those things than necessarily market share, which they've lost, and which is great for them, by the way. I mean, it is incredibly good for Apple not to have the majority of the market share because it keeps them out of all the things that would reduce their ability to move. If they were a majority holder of the market, they wouldn't be able to do a lot of the things that they do. It would be seen as antitrust. And so by remaining a minority stakeholder, it gives them, even though they're the largest company in the world, or publicly traded company in the world, it gives them a lot of flexibility to be aggressive in a way that they couldn't be otherwise. And so I think they're still in a pretty good position. I mean, obviously they need to continue to figure out how to expand I think they have to figure out how to expand that market. I don't think it's about getting more iPhones. They're going to keep on selling enough iPhones to keep the company open for quite some time. So, you know, I think we can look at it. I mean, there's another decade of them selling phones and coasting on that. Maybe it doesn't make as much money. I mean, the big problem that you get into with stock prices is not so much whether the stockholders are happy or not or whatever, but if the stock prices go down for too long, they have talent retention issues within the company. You know, people have, you know, so much of what you make in one of these technology companies is your stock. You know, you're getting stock buyouts, and so one of the big challenges for them is if the stock is going down or if it's sliding, it actually makes their engineering staff more flexible as far as where they want to work, and so that's probably the biggest reason for them. Otherwise, they're not really in any kind of particular danger. So, you know, and so it's good news to talk about how much trouble they're in, but I don't think they're in that much trouble.
Well, it's just fun to see any CEO who is as smart, talented, rich, and good looking, and apparently healthy as Tim Cook have to spend a day in the dunking booth. Because we don't get to be handsome or talented or smart or rich. So, but it's nice to see him see somebody in that position have to do a little bit of fancy footwork. And you do make a point that we're of course watching this for cues as to what Apple thinks the direction of the company is going to be. They certainly don't talk about unannounced products, but this is where they start to tip their hand as to, we feel as though this market is very, very interesting, and we continue to avidly follow events in this space. This is also the place where whereas they can say whatever they want at a keynote event and there are no legal repercussions for defending the deletion of the headphone jack on an iPhone, if they say things that are misleading or a little bit shady or a little bit weird, there are legal repercussions to saying that in official communication to shareholders. So those things are really worth taking a look at. But nonetheless, this is a financial call. Munster was talking about what they're expected to do with the money they're making. He said that the additional profits expected to go into boring things like servicing debt, paying dividends and doing stock buybacks, which are all about transactional stuff that's for the monetary health of the company, as opposed to we're investing in this company or we are moving into this additional market. But is it, Renee, do you think that they can, is there anything they could tip their hand about? There's something that's not in, I don't think we should, it's time to talk about Apple's AR, VR headset. The more rumors are kind of floating about, but those are so premature at this point that you may as well talk about Apple getting into a line of designer wallpapers and fabrics at this point. But do you think Apple's in a position where they can start talking about we are interested in creating new products as opposed to creating improvements on the lines that we already have?
I mean, in order to dodge questions about China, it could be fun. Apple historically hasn't done that. I mean, the closest they've come is Jeff Williams once mentioned that the car was the ultimate mobile device, and Tim Cook talked about AR quite frequently and more recently talked about autonomy and autonomous technologies, which is what the car project ultimately is becoming. So there's always a chance that he can swing back around to autonomous technologies. But I think, you know, Apple hasn't shipped AirPower yet, you know, and that was discussed back in September. So I think there's danger in sort of talking about future products when all the current products haven't shipped yet.
Yeah, that could be during the Q&A afterward in the phone call. That could be something that no one's looking forward to at Apple talking about. Okay, well, HomePod looked like it was set to be an incredibly hot seller for the holidays, and that got delayed. You kept talking about this air charger that hasn't shown up yet. The only news you have about the Mac Pro update is that it's certainly not going to be this year, and it might be next year. Does Apple have a problem with having people believe them when they say that we've got a plan for something and we're shipping something? Is Tim going to have to explain like all these shipment delays?
Which has really never been a problem for Apple. Tim Cook famously was the one who got all those products shipped on time and sometimes at prices that were astounding to people who worked in logistics. And now we've had AirPods and keyboards and Apple Pencils and AirPower and AirPods. And it sounds like they're struggling. I mean, they're shipping way more products than they ever did before. But at some point, you sort of have to huddle everyone back together and say this stuff has to go out on time or we're not talking about it till it's ready to hit the stores.
Yeah, I think that we're seeing some of the pressure that Apple is getting from Google and from other folks as far as the products that Apple has this idea of announcing products that are 2 months out or 3 months out or 6 months out, when they do that, when they don't wait until they're going to, you know, until it's done and ready to ship, that means that they're, I think that that means that that they are worried about other people taking market share before they get that out there and they have to talk about it. I think that, you know, if you look at the Apple speaker, it's 2 years too late, most likely. You know, the air, you know, it is a, Alexa has, and Google Home to some degree, but Alexa especially has kind of taken that market. They got out there early. It wasn't perfect. Didn't matter. They got it done. And I think it's going to be hard for them to catch up. So I think that you see them trying to make sure that they can stay out in front of those things. I think that I don't think that they're in any risk rate with AR right now, because I don't think anybody else has it figured out anywhere near figured out. But I think that's also a massive market. I mean, it's starting to be clear from some of the testing we've done internally and some of the stuff we've seen other people working on, that, you know, we're not going to be using our phones forever. The AR is the replacement for the phone. We just don't know exactly when or how.
Mm. And Kelly, this is another thing that kind of bothers me about these rumors about Apple having this really cool AR/VR headset with 8K individual displays and not making you look like a total dork, or in my case, any more like a dork than I already am. I don't want to fall into the trap of saying something that could be misconstrued as Apple can't innovate anymore. But I don't. When I think about my mental picture of Apple these days, I don't think of them as someone who breaks a new technology. That I think of somebody who refines an existing technology at a market that kind of worked, and the fact they took so long to get into these smart speakers. But I mean, am I off base? Is the magic still there?
Well, Apple was never they haven't been first, I guess, for a really long time. They didn't make the first MP3 player. They didn't make the first phone that you could get email on. They didn't make the first laptop. They didn't make the first, you know, any of these things. They didn't make the first tablet. They didn't make the first home speaker. But in a lot of cases, like, it didn't matter. Like, you know, how many people remember what MP3 players were like before there was an iPod? And how many people remember what there was aside from BlackBerry? Because remember, that was practically the generic term for a phone you could get email on before Apple came on the scene. So the problem is, does it matter? Because, you know, like we were talking about before, like, Apple can't win. So remember, like, they released an iPad in the spring, and then they released an iPad later in the year, and people went, Apple's innovating too fast, this is terrible. And then, like, when that iPad hit like 12 months, people were like, clearly Apple can't innovate anymore. So, like, it doesn't matter, you know. But like, the thing that I wonder about is the announcement. And like, I have a whole bunch to say about the HomePod, mostly because I don't think it's necessarily the head-to-head comparison with things like the A-Lady and the Google Home stuff that it tends to get portrayed as, because it has an assistant in it. Those were an assistant, and the delivery mechanism for that assistant was that speaker. Whether it was the tall canister of the Echo Base or the little hockey puck of the Dot, it doesn't, like, Amazon needed a way to get that into your house. And so they sort of slapped a speaker on it so that you would start using the A-Lady to do all of your stuff. That was the point of it. And Apple is trying to sell people a really nice speaker that you happen to be able to talk to, which is, like, not necessarily the opposite approach, but it's the other way to do it. If you're going to give people a speaker that you can talk to, like, Apple made a great speaker that you can happen to talk to, and everybody else made a thing you can talk to that happens to have a speaker in it. So yeah. I feel like there's probably more to be done there. And, you know, because, like, I have a great sound system. So I was never the market for the HomePod, and I was never going to be a person who could talk to Siri, like, on a speaker for that, because I already have awesome speakers and I don't care that I can't talk to them because I have an Echo Base and I use that and I talk to that all the time instead. So for me, this is going to be another one of those things where it doesn't matter. Like, if Apple releases something super innovative, you know, they're not going to win because, like, oh, what's Apple doing with all of this instead of, you know, whatever. And then if they turn around and ship everything that they said they were going to ship, and let's say we get a Mac Pro this year and the Air Mat or Air Power, the thing for all your stuff that charges magnetically. Like when that comes out that I can't remember the name of because they told me and I forgot about it because it never showed up. When that comes out, like if they shipped everything this year, if they just cleared the decks of all the stuff that we've heard about forever, you know, and they're like, here's your 5G MacBook Air and here's another new iPad and here's the iPhone 11 that does this other great amazing thing and here's the Mac and here's the Mac Pro and da da da, you know, and here's an 8K Apple TV, you know, like, will it matter? Because it's not going to make any difference. It's just going to give people a different set of things to complain about. Like, Apple released too much stuff. What are we supposed to do? Well, yeah. You know, like there's never going to be a good spot for Apple in this, but it has been notable to me that we've had so many announceware items from Apple instead of shipping things. So yeah. What would be surprising to me, or at least interesting to me, is if today on the earnings call, we got one of those, like we got occasionally in the old days of, you know, we've talked to you about this thing and it's coming out tomorrow or it's coming out Monday, you know, like really, really close to right now. And we're going to be able to release it. And we're just going to casually mention it in the middle of an earnings call, like that new version of macOS, it's out now, or, you know, whatever it is. So, that's part of what I want to hear in the call, is to find out if maybe there's something they're going to announce. Maybe we're going to find out that we're like 2 weeks from everybody having the Air chargy majig.
Yeah, I mean, we'd like to hear something. Anytime we hear something tangible from Apple, that's really good news. But my source of itchiness a little bit about Apple is that, yes, they weren't the first with the iPod. They weren't the first with the iPhone. They weren't even first with the iPad. But in each case, it fell into this this predictable rhythm of Apple saying, no, we weren't. We waited to see what you could do with a digital music player and what the pain points are. And we realized that what a digital music player needs is a lot of capacity. So we're using this brand new tiny hard drive and a really great way to move music from your computer to the device. So we got iTunes. With the iPhone, they said, it's these keyboard, the software is terrible. Multi-touch is the future. We built this iPhone, the engineers were saying explicitly, based on what we hated about our current phones. And the iPad fixed tablets, and I think that it also fixed cheap $200 computers, so like inexpensive computers too. But when I see the HomePod, I see we built one of – that's a popular product that Amazon introduced and that Google has built upon. We built one as well. How about the Apple TV? Which we also have a streaming box also. I don't necessarily associate them now with whenever they came up with an AR device, they will absolutely crack it, as opposed to they'll look what Oculus is doing. They'll look with all these other immersive experience devices are doing, and then find a way to make that enhances the Apple ecosystem. So That's just something to follow.
I guess the advantage that Apple does have with some of these devices, as someone who has probably all of them in my office, is that they'll be stable and they'll probably work. I mean, the problem is that my HTC Vive and my Oculus and even the, you know, those are all like, you don't know if it's actually going to work today or not. You know, Windows runs a forced update and now Oculus doesn't work, or I connected both of them and now that neither of them work. And then there's just so many things that go wrong on that platform that, you know, that it is, you know, that's the big opening that they have, that they're leaving open because they're not stable, you know, and dealing with all the little bits and pieces is something that I think Apple stands to be able to work better, because they're working the problem that Oculus and Vive have right now until they pull all of that in internally. And I think the Oculus Go is a good example, and the, you know, like those are things that they're starting to go down that path, but depending on any external hardware is, you know, and depending on Windows is a massive weakness for a lot of that stuff for high performance AR and VR.
Okay, Renee, you did mention China. What do you think that Tim might have to talk about if people have a chance to ask him anything about China? What's the red flag word?
I mean, China is a huge market. It's probably going to surpass the U.S. In terms of potential if it hasn't already. And Apple was doing pretty well in China, but local brands, you know, Huawei and ZTE, they're doing really good work now. They're becoming increasingly popular. Apple's fallen into the other category of vendors in China. And there's also an incredible amount of trade uncertainty under the Trump administration about whether there will be tariffs against China. The U.S. government has already banned phones by Huawei. And I forget the name of the second company that they banned. I don't think it was ZTE. It was the other one whose name escapes me. But and there might be retaliation, for example, with China barring Apple or American phones from coming into the market. So you have a highly competitive market where Apple's only advantage is that it's considered a sign of face, a sign of affluence to have an Apple product. But other companies are making very good technology stacks now, too. And you have what might be an incredibly hostile environment for American companies going forward. So we've seen Tim Cook actively, you know, go to the White House, the state dinner, have meetings in the Oval Office about this. But it really is beyond, a lot of it is beyond his control in terms of where the trade practices go. But also Apple's positioning. If you are considered the hot brand, it only takes someone considering something else hot to really undermine your position. So I think there's going to be a lot of questions about Apple's ongoing role in China.
One of the difficulties is in every single category, what once was cool and hot at some point becomes what your parents thought was cool and hot, which makes them much, much, much less hot and cool. But yeah, it's also notable, probably based on all that sort of stuff, that Tim Cook was invited to Donald Trump's very first official state dinner. This one was in honor of French President Emmanuel Macron. It was a smaller event than Obama's first state dinner, so a little bit more exclusive. It wasn't necessarily top heavy with tech execs. So, okay, that's interesting. But also interesting that he brought with him as his plus one Lisa Jackson, who is Apple's vice president of environment, policy, and social initiatives. Interesting in and of itself, but she's also a former Obama administrator of the Environmental Protection Agency. So it feels like maybe Cook was trying to have his cake and eat it too, that if he's invited to a state dinner, it's a really good idea as not only the CEO of Apple, but also as a leader in a certain industry who wants to retain a certain amount of influence to accept that thing, but also to bring in a former head of the EPA at the state dinner for administration, whose current EPA administrator started off as being an outspoken enemy of everything the EPA stands for and might wind up under some form of indictment. That does seem like a notable ask. It's not an old white dude. It's sort of like when you're invited to the White House Correspondents' Dinner and you choose to bring like one of the cast members of Jersey Shore. It seems as though you're trying to rattle things up. Alex, you spend more time in Washington for other reasons than I do. Is this a finger in the eye? Is this like him bending the knee? What do you make of this?
I think that he did two things. Number one is Facebook probably more than anyone else has realized what happens when you don't spend enough time and effort in Washington, D.C. I mean, there is a flow of things that can occur. A lot of tech companies, there are some tech companies that have definitely spent a lot of effort in D.C. And then there are other tech companies that have just thought they can just ignore them and not do anything. And I think that you find that a lot of the shifts suddenly come against you if you start to go down if you don't pay attention. So, coming to a dinner when you're invited by the president is probably a good idea. I think to avoid being seen as someone who's just coming to the dinner, bringing someone who is a signal that you're coming, but you're not necessarily capitulating, I think is not a bad positioning statement. In that area, I'm sure that it was probably a lot of appropriate conversations. She probably was not combative. I think it's just the presence in that picture that you saw was the important thing for Cook. That's my guess. And so I think it's an astute, very astute choice to be a little bit there and a little bit not there. But ignoring the president or DC is probably not an advisable solution if you're the CEO of the largest company in the world that can be affected by things like tariffs and all kinds of other stuff.
Kelly, do you think that Tim and Apple are facing problems by being seen as being more political or even just more social?
I'm sure they are, because, again, this is a thing that you can't win, because whatever position he takes, like, if he's on the middle, there's going to be people on the extreme ends that both don't like what he's saying. And if he takes something a little to the left, the right won't like it. If he takes something a little to the right, the left won't like it. So being public at all, you know, like, that's one thing that Steve Jobs sort of, like, never really got involved with for the most part, was just, like, he kept a really low profile and that kind of stuff and washed his hands of the whole thing so that there wasn't this kind of concern, I guess. I don't mind that Apple does it, whether I agree or disagree. Like, that's one person of many within a company. And I'm not saying that because he does stuff that I don't agree with. So far, I've agreed with all of it. But it is interesting to see them sort of get a little bit more political. And I don't know how much of that is the climate we are in now. And so they sort of feel like they have to in some way, and how much of it is just Tim was always going to be more public about stuff like this. And we should just expect that that Apple's going to have a little higher profile and stuff like this going forward.
Yeah. He also did meet privately with Trump a day later. And I'll throw this out to everybody. Does anybody think that Tim has a good chance of not just looking for staying in the loop, not just getting the best for Apple, but also influencing Trump on issues like how problematic a trade war with China would be, all the way up to like DACA and other social things that Tim has publicly stated are very, very true to his heart? Do you think that he has any kind of level of trust where he can start to say maybe the immigrant stuff is not a really good fit for America as the employer of many immigrants?
I think that the one thing Trump has proven is that he can't be moved around. I mean, as far as his opinion goes, so sometimes it changes like the weather. So I think that it is I think that having a conversation, you just have to figure out, I'm sure it comes with a lot of congratulatory and very nice comments. But in between that, I think there is an opportunity Trump, my guess is a lot more less dogmatic than many other presidents have been, and probably is a lot more flexible to the right kind of conversation. I don't think that it's got to fit inside of his world vision, but I think that Tim putting the right thoughts with him and his people may have some effect. I mean, he's the only one that's going to decide those things, but I think that it's not a bad idea to be able to at least give him your two cents and have him thinking through that.
I just don't know. I mean, I don't think Tim Cook will ever be in a position where he gets to be the last person who spoke about it, and then it's the person who's in the mind when the policy is, well, I don't know if policy is made or when the reaction happens. So he'll go in there and he'll talk, and it could make all the sense in the world. And then by the time it gets down to actually enacting the policy, it's whomever is in the office with him, whatever he's watching on television, that makes the biggest impact. So, but I think this really does show Tim Cook's consistent policy has been engagement, whether it's business practices Apple didn't like, countries that had policies Apple didn't like, or regimes that Apple had issues with. They want to stay engaged, and they believe, Tim Cook has said that they believe that if they aren't engaged, they can never affect change. So there are probably people, to Kelly's point, people who are more on the left who are really upset with Apple and how it works with the Trump administration on tax policy and repatriation, and on the right who are really upset with their stance on civil rights and immigration and all those things. So at least he's pissing off almost everybody equally, but he's staying involved and he's part of the conversation. And the alternative is not to be part of any of it.
See, and I don't think it's going to move the needle at all for him to talk to Tim Cook, because as far as we know, Trump doesn't have an iPhone, so he can't get any support from Tim Cook. So he's honestly not, it doesn't gain him anything to have that conversation.
He does. They took away his Android phone and they gave him an iPhone. And I think it only has Twitter installed on it.
Really? Okay. Well, then yeah. I take it back. Then that.
Can you put me some more apps on, Tim? Can you give me some more apps?
Yeah. What's with the birds? I hear they're very angry. I'm hearing. Yeah.
Before we go to our first ad, one last question. Who do you think has more influence on Trump at this point, Tim Cook or Kanye?
Well, I think that would definitely be Kanye.
Kanye.
Well, let's see what Tim's album does next. But before we will leave that for future discussion, because our friend and leader, Leo Laporte, who is off vacationing at this very moment. However, before delegating his responsibilities to Renee and myself, he decided there's things that he should best handle himself, including delivering advertisements from our wonderful sponsors. Leo, what you got for us?
Oh, man, I have a delicious coffee to share with you. And something I learned about coffee just the other day. Oh, that's Tres Pontas, P-O-N-T-A-S. You've heard of single origin coffee. This takes it to the next level. This coffee, Tres Pontas, is from a single family farm, the Race Family Coffee Farm. They're near the town of Tres Pontas. It's in Brazil. Brazilian coffee, it's the best. And, in fact, this is from the mountainous regions of Brazil, the Tres Pontas mountain range. Some of the best coffee beans in the world grow there. For over 100 years, three generations, the Race family has been growing some of the best premium gourmet coffee in Brazil. And now you can buy it directly from them. This is the first time they've ever exported their coffee to the U.S. I was a little skeptical until I tried it, and I'm blown away. Now, there's a couple of things that make this the best cup of coffee you'll ever have. First of all, because the coffee is grown in Brazil, it's one of the few coffee growing regions where they can do something called natural pulping, I guess they call it. It's pulped naturally. It's not washed. In many other regions, because they're extra hot regions, they have to wash the coffees. And in washing, they wash off some of the most important part of the flavor. And they wash in, I'm sorry to say, a lot of the bitterness that you're probably used to in coffee. Tres Pontas is naturally pulped. Because it comes from Brazil, they don't need to do that kind of washing. And that means it is the smoothest coffee. There is no acidity. It's 100% Arabica beans, non-GMO certified kosher, hand-picked, and then they roast it by hand in small batches right before they ship it to you. In fact, if you look at the package, the beans, every package labeled with exactly where it came from. This came from the Garcia Reis farm in Minas Gerais, Brazil. 1,100 meters, pulped natural. I'll show you the bean in a second. You'll like that. And I love this part. This is fun. When you get a new bag of coffee, by the way, notice roasted on date, so you always know it's fresh. And do you see that? The QR code on there? This is so cool. You scan this, and it goes to the website and shows you exactly on the map from Google Earth a satellite image of the exact place this coffee was born. Now, that is pretty cool. I mean, a picture of the coffee's birthplace. That's the farm this coffee came from. I love that. Let's open it up. I can't resist. I smell it. It smells so good. This is our, as I said, this is the, we got a medium roast here. This is from the, it's a Catuai pulped natural medium roast. I always get whole bean because I'm a fan of the whole bean. Actually, let's just cut it open. Save time. I can't, I'm going to brew some right now. Oh, so fresh. You know, they have the little pressure relief valve in here so that the oxygen leaks out so it doesn't. Oh, my gosh. Oh, my gosh. Look at that. Oh, that was last week. That was in Brazil. Oh, my gosh. You know, it's so good you could eat it. Pulp wash, which means the bitterness is gone. It is fabulous. Tres Pontas. It's the freshest coffee you've ever had. It's the most delicious. It's the smoothest. It's the best coffee flavor. You can get it roasted light, medium, dark, and French roast. Although, if you're really a serious coffee connoisseur, I mean, I would get a little bit of each. I use the French roast in my espresso. But really, to appreciate this coffee, get a good drip filtration system, a Melitta or a, Chemex, or maybe an AeroPress. That's what we use. Get the lighter, the medium roast. So the flavor is really there. You will be blown away. Most coffees, if you roast them dark enough, it doesn't matter if they're any good. You're burning it anyway. So that's why if you really want to see how good this coffee is, how smooth, how luscious it is, get a bag of the medium roast. You can get it shipped to you every week, every 2 weeks, every 4 weeks. Yeah, do the subscription by all means. 12-ounce bags. So that they're fresh and you'll use them up quickly enough so that you won't have to worry about it getting stale. You can get it ground if you want, but, you know, I would say get the whole bean, get a good grinder, get the medium or light roast, put it in an AeroPress. You will never have a better cup of coffee. Free shipping in the U.S. You'll save 10% off if you sign up for a subscription. 10% off every bag of coffee. Plus, and I have to really thank them for doing this. These guys are really cool. Because you're listening, you're going to get an extra 10% off. If you go to the website, and Tres Pontes, T-R-E-S-P-O-N-T-A-S, T-R-E-S, Trace 3, Pontas, which is points, right? P-O-N-T-A-S, I guess it's the 3 points of the mountain, .com/MacBreak, and use the code MacBreak. We'll get you 20% off. Now you're really saving every bag of coffee in your subscription. And by the way, that's forever. So as long as you keep that subscription active, you're saving 20%. And what a great gift for Mother's Day. If mom likes coffee, does mom like coffee? Your Father's Day's coming up. Grads, if you've got a college grad, what a great gift. Introduce him to the taste of real coffee, delicious coffee, from the Race family farm in Brazil. Fresh, roasted days before you get it. And so smooth. You can, by the way, order it on Amazon. If you search for it on Amazon, you'll see it. If you just want to try one bag, maybe that's the way to do it, but you won't get that 20% off. But if you just want to say, "Well, I want to try a bag," go to Amazon. But if you want, if you trust me, you will want to subscribe to it. 20% off every bag in your subscription forever. TRESPONTAS, TresPontas.com/MacBreak, and use the offer code MacBreak. The official coffee of MacBreak Weekly. And guys, each of you, we're getting you a subscription. Don't worry. And you will echo my surprise and my happiness when you taste how smooth this is. Naturally pulped. Never washed, so it's smooth and delicious. TresPontas.com/MacBreak. Okay, I'm caffeinated. What about you guys? Back to work.
You know, I mean, it's always have Leo read your ad copy. I have literally drunk four cups of coffee in my life. I'm not joking. I can count them. I've had four cups of coffee in my life, and now all I want is a cup of coffee. I can smell really great coffee in my office right now. So
I've
been
drinking the
Tres
Pontes for the last week, man. And it's delicious. It is legitimately delicious.
Oh God, I don't want to get hooked. That's the one. I already have my caffeinated vice. And I just I don't know if I needed another one. Hey, I got the new $329 iPad that was announced at Apple's event. This is Apple's loaner. This is not mine. But I'm actually kind of thinking about buying one for myself because the last part of my testing was last week when I went on. I was in New York City for 5 days for some business and some pleasure. And I decided, okay, great. I'm going to leave behind the MacBook. I'm even going to leave behind my 12.9-inch iMac Pro. My 12.9-inch iPad Pro. And just rely on the $329 iPad paired with a Bluetooth keyboard of my own abstraction, but still just that and the Apple Pencil. And I gotta admit, it did the job. It's like I wrote about 3,000 or 4,000 words. I took about 2,000 or 3,000 pictures. Some of those pictures I felt like I wanted to edit them in Lightroom Mobile and then post them or do something else that was cool with them. I was managing my inbox. I was managing calendars. I was doing a whole bunch of stuff for business that's going to be happening in the next 3 or 4 weeks. I have to say that I did miss having the larger screen real estate of my iPad Pro. I was missing how easy it was to have like a work pane and then on the other third just a Twitter pane or just a picture in picture. It's not as though this iPad can't do stuff like that, but it becomes a lot more, you know, a lot more Lilliputian when you're squeezing things down to that. It's not as though I felt as though I'm on the countdown to buy a brand new iPad Pro this year or next year, because I did buy the very first model that came out. I ordered it the same day it was announced. But I was sort of thinking that if the next model that comes out with a good, an interesting new feature set, I would certainly be liable for for another $1,000 purchase. Now I'm like, it's kind of nice. The size was the only thing that was. I'm a little bit torn on whether the size was a positive or negative thing, because it's certainly smaller. My other iPad is an iPad mini, which unfortunately is now so old that it really feels really slow when I'm using it. And this is no speed glitches whatsoever, even when I was doing video, even when I was doing photos. And it's small enough that I can one-hand it very easily while still being big enough to read comic books and stuff like that on. Unfortunately, it's just a little bit too big for my usual. I have one bag that I designate as the bag I take when I don't want to take something as big as a laptop bag. This is just it's small enough that I can fit in there so long as I don't also have like a camera lens and a charger and other things. It's okay for a few hours out, but maybe not okay for a trip. But I was surprised that even just simply as a solution to a future problem of when I need to get a new iPad, I might not even want to get the 10-inch iPad Pro. I might want to get this because it does the job, and I can for the money that I would have budgeted, I can certainly afford to max out the RAM, and it would just still do everything for me. So we have everybody who's in this conversation does way more traveling than they wish. Than as a kid, they'd be shocked that are you complaining that you get to travel so much? Yes, mm-hmm. Son, we're adults. The fact that we were home for 3 days, we have to eat all of the perishable stuff in the fridge because we're going to be leaving for another 2 weeks after that. That gets old after a while. Starting off with you, Kelly, what do you think is the best, even just for you, the best Apple product for someone who travels, who has to do a certain amount of work, like your kind of work? Like, what can mm-hmm. you get away with and what's ideal for you?
Well, I'm going to say ideal, and yes, I totally admit that I'm biased about this. And before I get too far down that road, I just want to say that the Apple's education event in Chicago was super amazing, and it was probably my favorite Apple event of all time. And that is because Tim Cook stood on stage and said App Camp for Girls out loud. And
yes.
So I'm still kind of back at that.
I had to tweet that out. It was like, yay! It wasn't just a logo. It wasn't just a logo in the cloud of logos. It was he actually said the words. Yes. I was so happy about that.
He said it out loud where people could hear him in public, and I promptly freaked out. So putting that aside, I have the 10.5 iPad Pro. I got one for Christmas. And I really like it. And part of the reason that I sort of held off was because I have a first generation Air, and it's that same slightly narrower on the sides bezel, you know, the leaner, meaner yeah. form factor. And that's a great size. I would honestly say that if you are not a person who has a specific need for the extra space, then the latest iPad, I haven't spent a ton of time with the newest one, the one you have in your hand. But it's a great device, and I would absolutely recommend that to somebody who doesn't have a specific need for it. And when I travel and need to take notes or don't necessarily need my entire computer to do anything, then I take my iPad and I have an Apple keyboard, the not magic one, the Apple wireless. And I take that and I just pair that up with my iPad. And then because no matter how good I get on the glass screen, I will always touch type faster than I can type on the screen of an iPad. And it doesn't matter how big the iPad is.
I envy the cast members of Star Trek: The Next Generation. They're really good at managing that LCAR system with just glass to type on. I unfortunately am stuck with 21st century brain and fingers, and I will type on the glass keyboard, but I will bring a keyboard if I can deal with anything else in my bag. Renee, like the thing that makes this interesting question to me is that Apple doesn't make any laptops that Macs that aren't really transportable. They have the MacBook Airs, they have the MacBook Nothing, which are tiny, tiny, tiny thin machines. But even the MacBook Pro is pretty thin and pretty light compared to the horsepower that they're packing. So you're running a media empire as you're scuttling between countries. So what do you travel with, and what do you think could be improved in the product line at this point?
So I have two answers to that. Typically, I've been taking the 10.5-inch iPad Pro with me because it really does combine. Like, it's got built-in LTE, so I can use it anywhere. I don't like connecting to coffee hotspots or hotel hotspots for security reasons. So I love that it's on my own network. I can use it anywhere. I love to use the Apple Pencil. I actually really like the smart keyboard. It's the only thing that I miss from the 9.7-inch iPad. I can type. We've established on the show previously that I'm really such a terrible typist that I can use any keyboard that anybody gives me. So I'm just as productive on that as I am on any generation MacBook keyboard. So to me, it's so sleek, it's so slim, it's so easy to travel with. I take it all the time, except when I have to do video work. I know Serenity Caldwell can just kill it with the iPad and iMovie and some of the other apps, but I'm just not as good. You know, I started video editing on the video toaster. I'm a relic. And I edit better on a Mac than I do on an iPad. And I know intuitively I should be able to just, like, I watch her. She swipes and cuts and moves, and it's amazing. It's like casting magic. But I can't do that yet. I need, like, the warm Linus comfort blanket of a Mac. So I've been taking the 15-inch MacBook Pro with me, and I vowed after having a 17-inch at my old day job years ago, I'd never go big again. But when I see the video, just the speed with which it can chew through 4K video files, and it's really 4K that tipped me back into the bigger MacBook Pros with the beefier graphics cards. But it just takes so much less time to do anything video related on a 15-inch MacBook Pro that I now sort of have this two-tiered system where I have the Star Destroyer of the 15-inch MacBook Pro, and then I have the Imperial Shuttlecraft of the iPad Pro. And I leave the Star Destroyer in orbit as much as I can, and I only take it out when I have to, and then I scuttle around on the shuttle as much as possible.
Yeah, well, Alex is interesting in that we were when the Quick Oats box version of the Mac Pro came out, you were saying how wonderful it is to be able to throw these in a backpack and use it as a portable Mac. Like, given the heavy duty stuff that you have to work with when you travel, do you have like a designation between the stuff that's going to have to be able to render green screen immediately, but you still have to travel with it, versus the stuff that you're going to use just to like play games and do email with? Like, is it possible for Apple to make anything that's portable that can actually handle the sort of work that you have to do?
I think it might be possible. I mean, I would love the form factor of the Surface, to be honest, with the Mac OS would be my preference. I really
like something with a detachable keyboard, like a transportable.
Yeah, or I'd rather have a better keyboard for typing. I still think that it's easier. I have this kind of odd thing where I'm constantly moving between my laptop, which is still a 2015 Retina, because I hate the USB-C stuff. I don't have my MagSafe is the number one thing that keeps me on my Retina.
But, no, same.
Yeah, and so, but so if I had a MagSafe, I don't think the rest of it wouldn't matter to me. I'd immediately get a new laptop. It's just literally, if you're traveling, whoever designed a took the MagSafe out of the computer doesn't travel, period. You know, and they don't realize how big of a deal that is and how it's every day and all the time. And so I have a Retina. I'm down. I'm not accountable for as much as I used to be. So I'm down to one Retina at a time when I travel, which is a good thing. Usually I used to have a primary and a backup that usually was there. I just wish I could draw on the screen. So I have this kind of odd thing that I go back and forth between my iPad and I know it sounds a little weird. I have one iPad that's all like, it's really got my, I'm logged into it. And then I have another iPad that I'm not logged into that. It's because we have a bunch of stuff that manages questions and interactions and stuff for hosts on shows. And so I need to have one that doesn't have any of my accounts on it. And it's got its own account that I can send links to and stuff like that. And so I have one of those usually plugged in there. I do most of my thinking on my iPad. So I have a lot of drawing programs. And so I sit there and I'm sketching and working on ideas and building. Like, I won't touch Keynote until I've actually gone through and sketched all my slides. Because it's just much faster. And so I do all that, and then I go back to Keynote and I build them all out. And so I build almost a deck a day on average. So it's something that's definitely a process. And so so I think that I do most of my actual interaction with people on my phone. So I mean, that's probably I definitely spend more time on my phone than I spend on anything else. And so I definitely, like, when I thinking of paying for an iPhone 10 doesn't mean anything to me, because that is the number one thing that I spend time on. So I take my photos with it. We work on Slack. So, you know, I run the whole the whole company's run on Slack. So it's and then I'm jumping between Messenger and messages and Hangouts, and depending on who the client is or who we're talking to. So it's my phone is probably the most important thing. If I'm going to walk out of the house, I'm not really thinking about my iPad. I'm thinking about my phone, and I can really write a lot with two thumbs. So, I've written pretty long emails with it. And so, so I think that my phone is the most important thing if I'm going to walk out of the house with, and then I will take an iPad if I'm just trying to think. I like to stay away from stuff. And the problem with the iPad replacing the laptop is A, getting video into it is hard. And B, the latency of getting from one thing to the other is high. So cutting and pasting is still this like pain in the neck, and you don't know if you're actually going to be able to cut and paste. So there's some apps that won't let you cut and paste, or some web pages you can't cut and paste. And that turns out to be a pain in the neck. And so if you're trying to do something, build something really fast, I find that the iPad, and you're using lots of different sources. You're jumping from this app to that app to bring something in. You're going to go fix this picture. You're going to bring it back in. You're going to do this thing. It's it's not that the iPad, you can't do it on the iPad, but it's a quarter of the speed. You know, and so I think that is the I want to go to the iPad every day. I want to go to the iPad, but I haven't found a way to get to sever myself from the laptop just yet. And at home, yeah. I use my iMac. I don't big screen. You know, it's connected to all my hard drives. So my laptop even is only used when I'm on the road and needing to do that kind of work.
Yeah, the file sandboxing has gotten a lot better since the first time I decided to go on a long trip with just an iPad, but it's still the sort of thing where you have to plan way ahead to make sure that at no point are you going to encounter a file that you have to be able to get onto this device and open with a compatible app. So you have to plan ahead to make sure that whatever you need to do, you can get that done, or be so all in on the iCloud infrastructure that it will be a transparent move from your Mac to your iPad. There were still a couple of times where not barn burners, but times where I was thinking, oh, what I want to achieve would be so achievable if I could just Bluetooth a file from my phone to this device. But of course I couldn't, because you can't do that. But before we move off, though, it seems like the iPads are getting so powerful, and the less expensive Macs and even the MacBook Pro in some instances is so limited, in the sense that they're starting to, let's make these super, super thin, let's delete ports, let's delete certain expandability options. It's sometimes I wonder if Apple's trying to make the case for anybody who come into the Apple store with, let's say, $1,000 to spend on a MacBook Air or $1,200 to spend on a MacBook nothing. And someone complained when I refer to the MacBook with the MacBook that has no suffix after it as the MacBook nothing. I use that only for clarity. I'm not saying this computer is a nothing. I'm not saying that you are a nothing for using or liking these things. I'm just trying to create a word picture of clarity here. People who might be coming in for a MacBook Air or a MacBook nothing, to at least give them the option of saying, well, gosh, if you want a super light and affordable mobile computer, you're not going to be able to plug stuff directly into anyway, why not get this wonderful iPad Pro? Because it'll probably do what you want to do.
I'd say 90% of the population could use an iPad Pro just fine. I don't think that it is an iPad and phone or whatever. I look at my kids, they jump back and forth between computers and iPads and so on and so forth. But they spend most of their time on their iPad, and they just move through the iPads really. I think the only reason they want to use a laptop is because you can't create Roblox environments on an iPad. So that's the that's their primary development issue. But I think that outside of that, they're fluid. And when I look at my parents, I mean, you know, I think my mom spends more time on her iPad than she does on her computer. And I think that people who are not doing anything that is that what I'm doing, which is that whole, I'm going to throw things back and forth, and I'm going to do all these other bits and pieces, I got to connect a lot of peripherals, I would definitely, if my life got simple enough that I could do that, I would never look back and just use an iPad. And I think that a lot of people you know, I think that a lot of people would. And so I think Apple's on the right. I mean, that tablet experience and the phone experience is the right solution. And it is the replacement for a vast majority of the population. I think there's a handful of us that are probably on the show that can't quite sever it just yet.
Yeah. I think it was kind of a mistake for I thought not the best message for Apple to send when they had that commercial of the little girl using her iPad to do all these sort of things over the course of the day. And then her mom's like, so what do you do on your computer? And she says, what's a computer? Because A, it makes us all feel about 18 years older than we really should be forced to feel like. But also, I think I like the idea of Apple's insisting that, no, it is a computer. Instead of thinking of the iPad as something you have never used before and you don't understand, it is just a computer. It's a computer that is extra thin and extra light and extra convenient because you only take a keyboard with you when you feel like you're going to need a keyboard. So I kind of wish Apple would stick to the messaging that think about buying an iPad instead of a MacBook.
The computer forces every other computer manufacturer to play on the iPad's playing field, and that puts everybody else at an disadvantage. So I mean, that's definitely why they're doing it is because by redefining what is called a productivity appliance as not a computer, they're creating an uphill slope for everybody else that can't build a tablet as good as they can. And right now, I think that's everybody.
And I've upgraded a number of people from older Windows laptops to an iPad. And part of that, I think, goes hand in hand with technological honesty. Like, sit down and tell me for real, like, what it is you really do with that computer. And finding out that it's, I have a little bit of online banking and I have some Facebook that I have to do. And I look at web pages for different things, like, you know, whatever those things are. And then being able to sit down and explain to somebody like how you interact with those is going to be a little different, but you're going to be better off with this other device. And having that, I've done a bunch of that flawlessly for a non-zero number of people. Like, it's been quite a few people who like, yeah, the Windows machine's on its last legs and I just don't know if I want another one. And well, what if you could have a computer that you could carry around with you everywhere? Like, you could sit in the living room, you can take it with you when you go someplace else. You know, if you want if you want to be able to do that, like, you have the opportunity. And then getting them to sit down and really think about what it is they do with their computer. And an iPad is more than up to the task for a lot of people. But I think particularly longtime users remember when you had to get a new computer every 6 months, or at least a new graphics card every 6 months. And all of that was, you know, you have to upgrade your computer once a year because you have to upgrade your computer once a year. And now that we've sort of gotten out of that and there's been more maturity in the platform and you don't have to worry about that kind of stuff anymore, I think it's gotten a lot easier for people to sit down and go, you know, I don't really need all that extra stuff. I don't need that whole monitor. I don't need to be dedicating the corner of my kitchen or my whatever room, you know, where I have this whole desk and this giant thing. Like, maybe they don't have to. Like, some people, it doesn't make sense for them to continue to have all of that hardware when they could do everything that they want to do on an iPad.
Yeah, that's critical. It's when you get people to say, you get yourself into so many ruts when you simply buy this thing because you've always bought this thing. And you start forgetting that a computer or a camera or an oven or even a car is a solution to a problem that you have. And sometimes in the case of, let's say, a car, the problem you had at age 16 might be different from the problem you had at age 30 or 35 or 40 or 50. And maybe the solution is not a car. Maybe your solution is something else. Similarly, if you're always buying brand new laptops every time you need a new computer, quote unquote, what do you do? What do you use a computer with? And could you do those things more efficiently if you had a magazine style computer that lasts for 12 hours on battery, doesn't get any viruses, almost never fails, and at least if it fails, at least it bounces you elegantly back to the home screen instead of giving you a blue screen of unhappiness. But speaking of unhappiness, though, gosh, we have to talk about that MacBook Pro again, don't we? Apple Insider has been following up on a lot of anecdotal stories by people who keep saying that their 2016 and 2017 MacBook Pro keyboards, these super, super flat keyboards with the extra luxurious 0.55 millimeters of key travel. Brand new design, and guess what? They seem to be doing very, very poorly mechanically. They decided to do some research, and they had a poll or a little canvassing of a large group consisting of actual Apple Genius Bar people who probably were not supposed to be talking to them in the first place, but also Apple authorized repair centers to get some data on this. So this is based on a selection of these stores. It's not based on all people's usage, but they say that 2016 keyboards seem to be failing twice as much as the ones made in 2015, the last one with a previous keyboard design. 2017 MacBook Pro keyboards, they're doing only slightly better. Here we're talking about they have data for the 2016 keyboards, not enough data yet for 2017, but they are saying that of the 1,904 service events that they recorded for the 2016 MacBook Pros, 114 of them were related to keyboard failures. And that's compared to 165 of the 1402. So basically, they're saying that there's 11.8% of those service events were related to the keyboard in 2016 MacBook Pros, compared with 6% the year before and 5.6% the year before that. Also interesting, they also got data on how often were these repaired machines coming back. And whereas the previous year, again, the last year with the conventional model, eight of the ones that got fixed came back once and none came back a third time. You compare that to the 2016 models of 165, 51 of them came back again. 10 of those came back a third time. And if you think this is merely an annoyance, realize that if this machine is out of warranty, and now many of those 2016 MacBook Pros are out of warranty, you don't just replace a busted keycap. You don't just replace the entire keyboard. You replace the entire upper case, and that is a $700 out of warranty repair. Renee, I remember one of the times we were talking about this. I slightly regret saying that this keyboard was a piece of garbage, because I should have used that waffle word that journalists use. For many users, it's a piece of garbage. From all but, let's say, a handful of sets of expectations, the logical, rational response is that this keyboard is a piece of garbage. I was mostly referring to how it felt like typing on it. That was also incorrect, because garbage has more than 0.55 millimeters of travel, unless you're, you know. Anyway, Renee, does Apple have a problem on its hands now? I don't know anybody who likes typing on it who doesn't add phraseology, like, keyboards aren't really important to me. And you have not only that, you also have now problems where it's now starting to get documented that these damn things are failing. Does Apple have a problem? Does Apple have to talk about this? Does Apple have to invite four or five journalists to a top secret area inside Apple to promise them that at some date to be determined later on, they will actually give us a keyboard that is comfortable to type on and doesn't break after a year? I leave the floor to you.
Yes and no. So I spoke to Mike, who did awesome research for Apple Insider on this, and he chose to focus on the percentage out of incidents that were keyboard related, which is super interesting and is one of the internal metrics that Apple uses, as far as I understand. But when you look at the actual numbers, 2014, you have, like you said, 2120 incidents, 118 keyboard. 2015, 1904, 114 are keyboard related. In 2016, those are down to 1,402. So overall, the MacBook, whatever Apple did in 2016, resulted in a far more reliable, or at least a MacBook that required less repairs than any year before, except for the keyboard. And the keyboard is up to 165 incidents. Apple will tell you they sold more 2016 MacBooks than they sold in the previous couple of years. That's probably true given the pent-up demand, so it's hard to adjust the numbers. But I think it's undeniable that keyboard incidents went up with the 2016 Mac when the rest of the computer went down. But then you look at the 2017 numbers, and they're not finished yet, because the computer went on sale in June and we're just beginning May. So there's like a month and a half of data that's missing. But they're on track to be about the same as they were prior to the 2016 MacBook. The incidents in total are way down again. They're down to 1161. So maybe that ends up being 1200, 1300. So they're still down significantly year over year. And the keyboard ends up being flat. So it's the one component that wasn't significantly improved. And when you look at how Apple handles this stuff, like Apple recently did a battery replacement program for this very MacBook for the escape key version, it has to hit a certain threshold. And then these procedures take place. If it's encountered more often than is typical or acceptable for this device. And the keyboard, even granted that it has a higher rate of failure than previous generations, is still nowhere near that. So in terms of if this was any other year, any other MacBook, and I say that as someone who had to have their 2014 MacBook Pro keyboard replaced, and it was a $400 repair that luckily was still under AppleCare because I'm paranoid and I buy AppleCare all the time, and they had to replace the entire top assembly because the E key wasn't working, and I had that repair done. These numbers aren't recall level, much less, you know, replacement program. Oh, sorry, these aren't replacement program level yet, much less recall number. But the sentiment in the media, and I'm not including Andy in that, but if you just look at everyone from Casey Johnson to Casey Neistat. You know
excuse me. I don't write for the Chicago Sun-Times anymore, but I am part of the media. I just meant
you weren't being hysterical and sensationalist about it.
Okay, I was being sensitive. I was being hysterical and sensational.
No. Okay, so I include Andy as someone who sowed the seeds of dissension and hate about this. No, I'm just kidding. But the media attention, like you have Jason Snell writing about whether they need a recall. You have John Gruber writing about how terrible the keyboard is. These are people who are traditionally very fond of Apple. The perception is so bad that I think regardless of what the numbers are, and I'm super happy we have numbers because I think it really does add context to what was previously an anecdotal discussion. I think these numbers no longer matter. I think that the sentiment is such that the product is almost toxic, certainly damaged, and Apple, you know, more than likely will. I don't know if they'll address it or they'll just improve the keyboard. And then, you know, Jim Dalrymple said this on the talk show earlier this week. You know, when people ask about it on background, they'll say, "Yeah, it's third generation switches or something." And I think the irony here is that these butterfly switches, the whole keyboard was designed to reduce ingress as part of the ability to make these machines more reliable. And the side effect is once something got in, it's much harder for it to get out. So it's. I think it went wrong, and Apple has to course correct it.
Mm. Kelly, what happens when they have a feature that at best the most love I ever hear about that keyboard design, failure rate notwithstanding, is that I got used to it? Like, at what point do you simply say that perhaps this is an area, does Apple say this is an area that perhaps we can improve things, and no one would complain that we got rid of that super flat keyboard? Does that, because that keyboard just looks like it's green and glowing at this point, at something you could make so many people happy by creating a new MacBook that had a halfway decent keyboard on it at this point.
Even exactly the same MacBook and just give it a better keyboard. And the problem is, I'm not the person to ask about this because this is my keyboard. And I will show you why this matters.
That's the stuff.
I use old school, clacky, giant, heavy. Like, I don't travel with this keyboard. I haven't liked them since we got away from the PowerBook model and the MacBook Pro model with the silver keyboard.
Yeah.
That was springy. Like, that was the last attached to a laptop keyboard that I like. As soon as we went Chiclet keys, I was out. Like, I actively started using an external keyboard on purpose because I don't like the Chiclet keys. I don't like that they're so thin. I don't like that I'm wearing them away just by using my computer all the time. I do like that it's backlit, but that's a thing that I'm happy to give up in order to have a keyboard I actually like typing on, because I don't like the throw on the little keyboards anyway. I have strong opinions about this, so like I said, I'm not the right person to ask. It makes my fingers tired to spend an extended... I keep looking over there because there's my laptop. It makes my fingers tired to type for an extended amount of time on that keyboard because I'm like bottoming out all the keys all the time because I'm used to using a keyboard that has actual throw. And so for me, like, it's a frustrating experience all around. So not liking the one that I have and then finding out like everything you hate about that keyboard is just magnified because the thing that you don't like is that there's no throw. And this one has way less throw than the one that you don't like that doesn't have any throw. That feels like it would be the most frustrating experience. So I've been actively really happy with my computer for that reason alone. Not that reason alone. I really love MagSafe. I pink puffy heart MagSafe All the Live Long Day. And I was never a fan of that keyboard in the first place. And I've spent a little bit of time typing on like the first iteration of it and really like actively hated it. Like, I don't like the keyboard I have now, but I hated typing on that one. It was the worst. And so, I think it's interesting that this, we've got this like Antennagate sort of optic situation with this thing right now. I'm going to be interested to see what Apple's next move is going to be with it. After seeing like, and part of that is because I feel like there's a philosophy that brought us this keyboard, which is the computer always needs to be thinner than the last one. It always needs to be lighter than the last one. And I don't subscribe to that. I would be happy with a computer that's exactly the same thickness that had a decent keyboard on it. Even if they just went back to the chiclet model that has a tiny bit more throw than the one that exists. Like, I don't know anybody who would say, you know, the problem with my current Apple laptop is that it's just too thick and too heavy and I need it to be lighter. And I'm more than happy to spend the bulk of my time that I use this computer with this terrible keyboard when the primary thing I do with it is type on the keyboard all the time.
Well, and I think
that's frustrating.
I think that one of the things that's interesting listening to you talk about it is I really there's some of us that are truck drivers about our computers. We need big computers. We need them to last long. We need them powerful. We need thick keyboards. And we're the last ones using the computer. So the thing is that when you think about Apple like specializing, yeah, you're absolutely right that making the computer thinner for the people who want it to be more powerful is going the wrong direction. You know, in a lot of ways, it might make more sense for Apple to just say, okay, we're going to make iPads that are great and they're thin, and that's for everybody who cares about thin. Then we're going to make laptops that are horses, you know, that have the keyboards that we want to write on. They last for 18 hours. They, you know, those types of things, and they have a MagSafe. But we're not trying to make them thinner and thinner and thinner and more efficient, because you're solving a problem for a group of people that are going away. Rather than allowing us to have, you know, like for us, you know, for me, for a Mac Pro, I want the next Mac Pro, I'm hoping, is rack mountable. You know, like, I don't need the round. I don't, you know, I want a 3U rack mount and just make it modular and call it a day.
As a group of people, though, like, even if we're going away, like, I don't care if my computer is 2 ounces. If I get a new computer, I don't care if it's 2 ounces lighter than the one that I have. Like,
I don't care
they've
if it's
done all that work already.
I don't care if it's 2 pounds heavier. to be clear, I mean, like, if someone said it's going to be 2 pounds heavier, you're going to have a real keyboard and you're going to be able to last 18 hours and have a MagSafe, I'd be like, just where's the money? You know, like,
shut up and take my money.
There's not enough of you though, Alex, and that's I think.
But we're the only ones left to buy the computer.
Apple sales skyrocketed, at least the most computers we vote with our wallet. As much as I love like all the Mac Minis and the Mac Pros, when we vote with our wallet, people overwhelmingly buy these small, sexy computers, even if they don't need them. They just decide they want the MacBook Pro and they buy it. But what I think is incumbent on Apple, like what they're doing with the MacBook, now, the modular MacBook, is to make that computer, even though it doesn't sell a lot. So I was perfectly fine with this MacBook Pro, but they made the low-end model with the escape key and the one port. That's fine, MacBook Air, whatever replacement, but they didn't make the one on top. And if they'd made the one on top that had the big graphics card and didn't last that long, like did everything else the same, but added one SKU on the top for people who really want that Alex Lindsay machine, then I think they would have saved themselves 2 years of pain. We have been the same part of the company.
Yeah, you know, Kevin Hansen in our company still has the 17 inch, and when he opens it up, I'm just like, I just miss it. And he has it because it has an NVIDIA chip in it, and it still runs some stuff faster than the current MacBooks, you know. And so, anyway, it was just I still miss my.
Yeah, make that just like you're making a Mac Pro.
Yeah, just yeah. Yeah, you're right. Give us one more, because I think that the problem is that yeah, people are buying the smaller ones, but not as maybe they're buying them because they're thinner. Maybe they're buying them because they're cheaper.
No. They're buying them because they think they still need a laptop, and if I want to unplug it and take it somewhere, it's not a whole thing like it was with the 17 inch. Oh, 17 I still know a couple people that have the 17 inch PowerBook. The issue is that between model years, I don't necessarily need it to be any thinner anymore. I feel like we've gotten to that point. We ditched an optical drive. We ditched the spinning hard drive. Like, everything in it is flash and solid state. It's got a good reputation. It's got good battery. It's got great battery life. And like, I don't feel like I need it to be any thinner and any lighter than it is now. You know, it's the same thing I think about my phone. Like, I don't need my phone to be any thinner.
People go into Best Buy and do that. Like, they lift them up and they see which is a lighter one and they buy the lighter one. It's the same reason they buy the terrible television sets.
I think if you want that thin one, just go get an iPad.
I've never seen that. So I can't say, like, I can't say that that's a thing that actually happens. But like, for me, that's a thing that I've looked at is like, I don't need it to be any thinner. I don't need it to be any lighter. What I need you to do is give me a better graphics card or give me a better looking screen or give me a nicer keyboard or do something cool with the trackpad like they did. I have one of the, you know, the first models of the MacBook Pro with the nice non-diving board trackpad, you know, and it's been really like, I really enjoy that tiny little thing. And my computer didn't have to be any thinner or any lighter for them to give that to me.
Well, and I would say
that would be great.
I would say that the number one reason I have friends moving away from the Mac platform is because they're buying PCs that are more powerful with more battery power, and those PCs are twice as thick and twice as heavy as the Mac, and they want something that they're not going for thin, they're going for power. And, you know, and I think that Apple is you know, Apple may be selling a lot of those, but I think that Apple has a market where they have to decide what the Mac is going to be doing in its last little bit. And I think that, you know, there's iPads for 90% of the population. If they want to serve that last 10%, and maybe they don't, maybe they have a shelf life for the Mac that they're trying to move us all towards, but they're bleeding out a lot of people who are like me, that I have a PC, I have a Razer that I do my stuff on because I can't, not because I have apps that, I mean, I have some apps that only run on it, but the primary reason I do it is faster.
Yeah, the Mac is across the board, including all models, 9% of sales right now. And Apple has a responsibility and a problem in that they have to manufacture every single Mac that's available for sale. And so it becomes difficult for users. It becomes difficult for Apple when they decide that we are not going to give you any choice of keyboard, whether you give us $800 or $4,000 for a laptop. It will have this horrible 0.55 millimeter of travel keyboard on it. You can give us $10,000. It will still be this 0.55 millimeter keyboard. So I don't think that Apple has proven that people like thinner stuff. It's that they don't hate them as much enough to switch to Windows over it. Well, whereas if they signed such a horrible deal with Power Computing, they were so desperate for money if they signed such a horrible deal that it's like the deal that Marvel signed when they sold the rights to Spider-Man and the X-Men, saying you get to make movies as long as you want, so long as you keep making movies. We can't cancel this for any reason if we suddenly become bought by Disney and become a multi-billion dollar corporation. If this company decided we're still in business or was leasing its rights to Lenovo, and Lenovo could make one ThinkPad that runs the Mac operating system, so you get a great keyboard, you get actual ports, you get the same performance, you get the same screen. Then we get to stack that next to the MacBook Pro and see if people actually like thinner, lighter, terrible keyboard, all USB-C ports. Otherwise, we have to decide that people are not hating this enough to abandon all of their apps and all their services and all their workflows.
Well, I still think that if Apple wanted to burn the house while they're leaving it, there's a PC market and everyone's got all their ideas and everything else. If Apple wanted to burn that down, what they would do is they would license the operating system, because suddenly all these guys could, because the thing is that they don't need it anymore. Back then, Apple needed the revenue from the Mac and it was going to kill the company to do what they did. And the primary problem that Apple had back in the 90s was that they licensed it out and they wanted to do their primary license for the G3 was supposed to go out to everyone else, and the G4 was going to be the app one that Apple maintained more control, made more money. The problem was the G3 team built a larger L2 cache. And so the G3 was actually coming out as powerful, more powerful than the G4. And so the problem they had was the low cost computers were about to outperform the high cost computers, and if they didn't plow them all into the ground, it was going to wipe the company out, you know. And so the thing is that and that's coming from chip guys, you know, like they were, and they're all in the same company building the chips. Well, no, and one team just said, well, it was like one of those notes. We're going to make the L2 cache bigger, and no one really noticed, didn't realize what that was going to do, you know. And when they figured it out, Apple was in big trouble, you know. But now it's like almost a rounding error what they make on their Macs, you know. And if they wanted to really push people, like create havoc in the PC market, push people in more towards iPads, all those things would, you know, it would create chaos if Apple suddenly made that operating system more available, let people customize it, let people, you know, have the computers they want with the operating system they want. That all of that stuff would, it's a much different place than they were when they did it before. They don't need the money. What they need to do is, I mean, it would do them good. I mean, from a Machiavellian perspective, to create havoc in a market that they don't need anymore.
All I want is for Apple to allow me to run it in VirtualBox on a ThinkPad. That's all I want.
Ben Beharin, before the rumor started, he said that the PC market is finally getting profitable, and the best thing Apple could do was release an updated MacBook Air and slash $100 out of it, and it would suck the entire air out of the PC resurgence. And now, you know, that's a hot rumor now, although the rumor now is that it's going to move from WWDC to the September. Mm-hmm. But there's still a lot of room for Apple to move in the PC market. It's just not a direction everyone, especially traditional Apple people.
I mean, I just want to, as a hardcore user, I want to build a PC with 4 GPU, you know, 4 1080 cards or 1090 cards, and have a Threadripper in there and put all the stuff in there, and then install Mac OS on it and then do the work that I do, you know. And I think that there's a lot of people that would do that, you know. And I think that anyway, Apple's never going to do it, but we can dream.
We can dream. And while we dream, let's go back to Leo for another wonderful message from a sponsor for whom we are very grateful.
Mac Break Weekly brought to you by, we love this, Texture, the Netflix and magazines, more than 200 magazines for one flat rate, all the magazines you love. It really is a revolution in magazines. First time anything new's happened since magazines were published for the first time 300 years ago. I mean, this is the revolution. You can get all the top magazines in one place. You never have to pay for a subscription or pay the newsstand price. You just get it all. It's great for travelers. Put it on your iPad, your iPhone, your Android device. You can read to your heart's content. They've got curated picks so that you, if you're looking for something to read, you will always find a great article. They've got current events, politics, lifestyle. Yeah, you get your Hollywood gossip. See, it's great for me because I can read the Hollywood gossip magazines without actually buying them. Oh, I don't read those. Well, I also read the highbrow stuff. The Atlantic, the New Yorker, love National Geographic. Those images look so good on texture on that iPad screen. Much better than print. In fact, really, in every way, this beats print. It's much more compact. You don't have all the clutter. Your coffee table's not groaning. You don't have the guilt of magazines piling up that you haven't read. You just read it when you need it. And it's great for traveling because when I favorite my magazines, they automatically download. It's like I have a stack of great reading to bring on the plane with me or wherever. Just, it's one of the best things to do on your iPad. If you sign up right now at texture.com/twit, you're going to get a free 7-day trial. TEXTURE, texture.com/twit. Start reading the latest issues of your favorite magazines today. texture.com/twit. We thank them so much for their support of Mac Break Weekly. And by the way, congratulations to them. I think they've done quite well for themselves, if you know what I mean. texture.com/twit.
We're going to get to their picks of the week after, but not before what I have to designate with a heavy heart. Nothing gold can stay. Pony boy, spring and summer and fall are filled with winter. There is no coin that has a heads, but no tails. There's a time to every purpose. Sha-la-la, la-la. And so it's with heavy heart that I announce that I declare that this is Mac Break Weekly's last segment that is fueled by incredibly good, well-sourced Apple rumors provided by analyst Ming-Chi Kuo of KGI Securities. I'm going to give that announcement a little bit of air as we collect our thoughts and our feelings about this. And while we are finding our own personal peace with that news, wishing Ming-Chi Kuo a very the best of success. We're sorry to see you go, but he is leaving KGI Securities, according to the China Times. His last day at that firm was April 27th, and he is taking a job with another firm where he's going to focus on larger markets and emerging industries and not simply focusing on Apple. That is the three syllables Ming Chi Kuo are what you, if you heard that in anywhere within the airspace of an Apple rumor, you thought, I've got to take this rumor seriously, because, well, I'll be darned, he could say that Tim Cook is developing genetic profiling that will allow us to surgically implant a third leg upon many Olympic athletes. And you'd have to say, if Ming Chi Kuo got rumor of this, there has to be something to it. I don't know how they would monetize that.
Only if it was being built on a Foxconn pipeline.
Maybe. But so this is probably the last we'll hear of something that is, again, we don't really have to think as hard about it as we normally would, because, again, Ming Chi Kuo saying that his last report was about a week and a half ago about plans for the new iPhones. He says in 2018 there are going to be three coming out. And okay, we talk a lot about iPhone rumors, but this is kind of interesting in that he's specifying that there's going to be an iPhone Plus that's 6.5 inches, which sounds ginormous, but also a cheaper iPhone X SE, if you want to call it that. The idea being, let's find ways to retain most of the signature features of the iPhone, like Face ID, while finding ways to make it less expensive, such as switching from an OLED display to LEDs, keeping the Face ID camera on the front, but switching from two cameras in the back to just one, maybe even swapping out the glass back for an aluminum back, and also ditching wireless charging entirely. But the other interesting bit is that Apple would be deleting 3D Touch on this less expensive iPhone 10. I'm sorry. The other really interesting thing is that he says that it could be as inexpensive as $550. He has been adjusting that for the past 2 or 3 weeks. But the idea of something as cool as the iPhone 10 with Face ID selling for much less than the stock iPhone answer has always been is really, really cool. But saying that that one of these three iPhones will not have 3D Touch, again, as a cost-cutting measure. But also, it kind of makes sense, not just because Ming Chi Kuo is talking about it, but also that it seems like something that Apple could get rid of and not put a whole lot of noses out of joint. Face ID, they can't really get rid of that. They can't get rid of Touch ID on the less expensive phones, because those are signature features that feed into so many things that people use the iPhone for. Touch ID, because it's never been platform-wide, developers have never been able to make it sort of a mandatory feature. It's a nice power feature, but I've never really missed not having it on, say, my iPad. Kelly, as a developer, would 3D Touch be missed, and how important do you think it is that developers consider 3D Touch as part of an interface?
I think it's important. See, this is kind of a weird question because it depends. Like, there's times when it's obvious, like when you press on the camera icon and you can take a selfie or take a video or just use the camera, you know, you can do that. Or using the phone, like this is the one I use constantly because I'm still one of those weirdos that makes phone calls. And I can force touch the phone icon and choose which person I want to call right from there. Or messages, probably the only one I use more than the phone. The phone 3D touches, the messages 3D touch. And I use it constantly. And those are places that it makes sense. And there's probably applications where it doesn't make the most sense. Like, you know, I don't know what Angry Birds would gain, for example, from having 3D touch on the icon. I don't know what that would give you. But mostly, like, the thing about it is that it was an interesting technology to me because it sort of brought right click to the iPhone, and I thought that was really exciting. And I'm a little disappointed that not as much stuff uses it as I thought was going to end up adopting it. I really thought it was going to be a thing that was going to just spread. And maybe it's just because the apps I use the most don't have it, or I don't know, like, how I use the app doesn't lend itself well to that 3D touch interaction. But I don't understand how that's a thing that they would get rid of only because it's a feature that you get for free. Like, they've done all the R&D, they've released it on more than one model. It's reliable on all of those devices. And so you get it for free. It was one of those things that I sort of always attributed the 4S to when they just continued selling the 4S for like 2 years more than the regular life of an iPhone up to that point. Like, you could just still just keep buying a 4S. And I always thought it was because like they did all the work to turn it into a thing. And so everything they got out of doing that, like, is free from now on. Like, you know, the portion of the purchase price at that point is a lot more profit, you know, when you bought it after it had been out 3 or 4 years than it was on day one. So, like, I don't understand why they would get rid of it. I feel like there's more to this story because it seems like a lot of times when I read stuff that he's written, and let's pour one out for him because, you know, he's going to be gone. Part of the reason that I sort of doubt it is because, like, a lot of times when I read the article, like, he says it's going to be this, or it's going to work like this, or there's this thing that's coming or going or whatever it is. And then he says, you know, or not. Kind of at the end, and there's like a lot of bet hedging, and, you know, and when you come out that way and don't just state it outright, then, you know, you can point to, well, there at the bottom I said or not, so see, I'm right, because they didn't.
Well, and you always got to make sure that you say that I have not. There's hedging, and then there's also saying I will stand by this with my last ounce of my child's blood. You never know what's going to happen in the future, right? That's kind of okay. But part of the problem is that I've got my Android phone, and I've always had, even on the iPhones, I've had a problem with telling the difference between a 3D touch and simply a long press. If I long press the camera icon on my Android phone, I also get take a selfie, take a video. And Renee, I did want to hear a lot from you, because I know that you're an avid user of 3D touch and you really love it. I mean, but you also said it's some cool stuff about the difficulties in getting it to work with the iPads. That's also kind of always struck me as kind of a problem, that if you can't get this feature as a signature feature of iOS and it's just limited to the iPhones, is that the best way to get this done?
So, I mean, there's a lot to unpack there. One is, I'm not pouring anything out for Ming-Chi Kuo, because I think KGI Securities will just get someone else to exfiltrate information from the Chinese supply line. I mean, he was singularly gifted at only, you know, going to the supply lines and getting them to tell him what Apple was working on. And that, I think, is imminently replaceable at KGI.
Mostly, I'm super interested to see what he does. I just wanted to show off my R2-D2 water bottle. Like, the point of it was, my water bottle is amazing, and it has my name on it, which is very important. And
well,
that
you
was
win,
really cool.
You win the internet. So I think, you know, we'll be getting tons of rumors from KGI going forward. For 3D Touch, Apple has set an expectation that you don't have 3D Touch on the budget devices. The iPhone SE hasn't had 3D Touch, and people have been super annoyed by it. At least people keep complaining, why is Apple not bringing it here? When's it going to be here? People complain that it's not on the iPad, and it's that lack of consistency. And it is hard on the iPad, because for LED displays, Apple uses the deformation of the glass being measured by the LED to determine the point and the amount of force being applied, and that doesn't scale across a very large surface. It becomes very hard to measure that accurately. On the iPhone X, because they have OLED, which doesn't have a backlight, they had to create a whole new touch layer, which is probably more expensive just because it's all new, and bringing that. That'll be in what's in the new iPhone X2 or whatever they call it. Who knows? But if they're making a lower price phone, just like with the iPhone SE, they may not include it. The other reason it's not on the iPad is that part of the reason Apple developed it was because the iPad is a split view controller. It's got the master detail view. So it's got the list view and the master detail view, one on each side, and you don't have that on iPhone typically, except for the really large one in landscape. But they wanted a way for you to be able to preview your mail. Like on an iPad, it's super fast. You go down your mail messages and you just see them one after the other really rapidly in the detail view, or you go through your messages and you see everything in it. But on the iPhone, it was tap, go to the next view, tap back, tap, go to the next view, tap back. So they were hoping that you would just press a little bit, peek, press, peek, press, peek, and be able to go through that very quickly. So you don't need that part of it on the iPad. But the shortcuts have proven, among some people at least, and, you know, Andy's, some users from the previous segment have found it really handy to be able to do things like do the force press to bring up what Kelly was talking about, like even the battery shortcut to go into low power mode immediately or go into selfie mode. And I think the best thing Apple could do there is just merge long press and 3D touch. They shouldn't be discrete gestures because that creates too much collision. And like trying to put jiggly mode on to delete app icons when you can't press too hard, but you can't press too quickly, it won't work. I mean, it's infuriating. But if it didn't matter whether you did 3D touch, force press, I'm just gonna call it force press, or long press, and you could do that on either device. You would just long press on the iPad. That's fine, and you could do that on the iPhone. But if you know about 3D touch, you can just press it hard, because I think Fitz's law for glass surfaces is the angrier you are, the harder you press, and just naturally goes to 3D touch. I think that would work better.
And 3D touch was not great for me until I went into the preferences and found the adjustment level that I needed, because I was doing a lot of force press instead of long press. And, you know, like, oh, I want jiggly mode. And no.
Yes.
Once I was able to make that adjustment. So for people who like, maybe want to play with it a little bit more or have tried it and failed at it, like, go adjust those preferences. It's one of those things, like, if you take a couple of minutes, like, if you have trouble with Touch ID, if you take a couple of minutes and go delete your fingers and go put them back in, just like, you know, it's the same thing. If you go in and look at that preference and make a little bit of an adjustment, then it can be a lot more useful. And that was basically the magic for me. And then trying it on stuff, like just remembering that it was a feature that I could play with and then using it, like adjusting the brightness of the flashlight so that I can go from full on blinding to slightly less blinding, you know, if I need it to be a little bit less blinding. And then using all the different force touch features that Apple built into stuff, like finding those was part of what I liked about it, because it gave me new ways to find the apps useful and to be a little bit more efficient. Like, I don't have to tap four times to go in and call somebody, you know, that's on my favorites list. Like, I can just force press and it's right there.
Well, I don't know if anybody would be pouring one out for the 3D touch. Like I said, I love that they did what Renee said, which is to combine long press and 3D touch. Because even on when I spent like a month using an iPhone to test it out as my exclusive one, I was still by the end of the month still kind of confused as to what happens when I long press. I will thank you for referring to jiggly icons, because all while you've been talking, I've been thinking about the Pokemon Jigglypuff and hearing his song in my head. Which is not the sort of thing that someone who's hosting the show should be focusing on instead of what the guests are talking about. Oh, well, let's get to picks of the week. Before we do, though, make sure we want to convey a programming note. We normally record on Tuesdays. Next Tuesday is going to be Google I/O's big, big keynote. And so we have been dislodged for one day, so the Twit can cover that stuff live. So if you do like to listen to us speak live, we're going to be one day late, I believe same bat time. But we're going to be hearing us live on Wednesday. Podcast listeners, I don't think that ain't no need to break your stride. But once again, if you want to get the live show with all the cursing intact, you're going to have to come a day late. Alex Lindsay, let's start with you. What is your pick of the week?
So I'm doing an anti-pick. So kind of a reverse
pick. So you're throwing something out.
Will this give me back money, Alex? Is that what this is going to do?
Ooh. Sorry. I like it already.
Yeah. So years ago, I recommended an app on the phone called the NPR app. All right. And it was kind of something that I used every day, all day, you know, morning and afternoon. I would open up the NPR app. I would grab the stuff I wanted from Morning Edition. If I hadn't listened to afternoon, you know, All Things Considered the night, the day before, I grabbed the stories and say, I like NPR, but I don't like everything. Like, I can listen to Marketplace all the way through, but NPR, I'm like, there's a lot of boring stuff at especially the end of the hours. And so I would just grab the things that I was interested in. I'd reorder them so that just in case I ran out of time, I was able to listen to them. And so I'd put all that my little playlist together, and then I would start driving. And that's usually how I built my drive time. And then if I got through that, then I'd listen to Marketplace, then I'd listen to Twit, then I'd listen. It was like this kind of like mixture of how much time I have. So a couple weeks ago, NPR updated the app, and it is possibly the stupidest, most idea that I've ever seen anybody do to their own app, which is they basically
he's burning his tote bag in disgust.
I'm never giving them money again. Like until they put the playlist back, they will never get money from me again. You know, this is I can only think that they're trying to get people to listen to the radio more. You know, like because they took it away. You know, and because what I will admit is that once you got used to building playlists on the NPR app, the idea of listening to the radio was absolutely painful. Like the idea that you would turn the radio on and be stuck with, all the stuff that you get stuck with on a radio broadcast. Mostly just the stories being in the order that they were. You know, once you got used to the playlist, that's all you listen to. And you got to get, I was listening to this before the app. I was listening to it on the Flash player that they had in 1999. You know, so this is something that they've had for a long time that they literally severed the best part of the app. And now and then they have NPR One. You can kind of build something and then, I don't want them to choose anything for me. I don't want them to figure it out. Like, I just want my app back. You know, I just want my playlist back from NPR. And literally, it's been interesting because now I've had a couple weeks of not listening to NPR, which hasn't happened since I was 12. You know, like, you know, so you know, like, it is, you know, I mean, for it to be severed, because you can't go back to the radio once you're used to the playlist. And, you know, like, you're just frustrated. It's just angry. You're like, oh, I can't believe I'm listening to this. You know, but it literally is a great example of an app development where when you take something away, like you really should think about like how people are using it. Cause I can't understand. Like I can't understand the thought process. In fact, I've actually been going through my old phone, seeing if I have the old version, and then I'll turn updating off. And then that one will just sit in my car so that I can actually mm-hmm. listen to the radio. You know, like it's the most amazingly stupid update ever, and so I've taken it off my phones because I don't need it anymore. Anyway, not that I have an opinion about it or not.
And no, I mean, there are a few things more heartbreaking in like technology than when you have an app or a piece of hardware or whatever that you love, and then they quote update and improve it unquote, and it's ruined in your eyes.
It's not ruined. Like literally, NPR. Until I get that playlist back, NPR is dead to me.
So your best friend has just upgraded, downgraded from alcoholism to pure meth addiction, feel like you need to kick him out of your life until he cleans his ass.
Alcoholism, everything was fine. You know, okay. Like it was a great friend. We got along really well, and then he immediately went to killing my dog. That's how I feel.
Okay. That's a pull quote that's going on the box.
I'm just saying, like
maybe
stealing my dog, because if he gave the dog back, I'd probably forgive him. I really like him. I you know, but he took my dog. You know, like he took my dog. Anyway, there you go.
Wow.
Note: he took my dog as the show title for this episode.
No. And here's the thing. Is my request for everyone listening to this show is to go to the NPR app and give them one star. That's my request. I'm going to try to use the
okay.
We're going to show the power of MacBreak right now. Is go to the NPR app, give it one star, so they get a message that they should put the playlist back. So anyway, that's
okay. Well, I'm not saying this as someone who occasionally does tech stuff for Boston's public radio station and who was on Morning Edition this morning. As a matter of fact, I'm as a completely independent observer and thinker. I just want to say, Alex, by all means, listen to Alex if you want to listen to Alex. I will as a bookend to that, as a companion piece of that, I will only say I have a particular one-star reviews are to me like a particular button, because when I see a one-star review, I'm thinking that so if I downloaded the NPR app and the NPR app just simply like repeated all over and over and over again, just Alex, you suck. Alex, you suck. Alex, I hate you. Alex, everybody hates you. Alex, you stink. Alex, you're horrible. Alex, you're ugly. It would still have gotten a one-star review, meaning that there's no way it could possibly have received this is why this is why two-star reviews are very significant to me, because someone says that I acknowledge that it could be worse than this, but I didn't like it. So that's all I'm saying. Again, everybody speak with your heart. And now, Renee Ritchie, please speak with your heart. What is your pick of the week?
So I also don't have a pick. I have a tip this week, and it's actually in honor of this show. Apple, you know, we talked about this previously. Apple's not going to have a new modular Mac Pro ready until 2019. So we have one of our writers on iMore, Anthony Casella, is doing a series on how to update your cheese grater Mac Pro. You know, if you absolutely positively do not want the garbage can, and no one should at this point, and if the iMac Pro is simply not for you, he's doing everything. The current article is how to add Bluetooth capabilities to it so that it can be it can work with Continuity and the other modern Bluetooth 4.0 based features. He's going to do I think the article he's working on for tomorrow is how to upgrade the processor. He's putting a Westmere, if memory serves, a 12 core processor into what was originally in the Halem Mac Pro, and he's going to go through component by component, upgrade the storage, the graphics card. I think he's putting I forget what he's putting in there, an AMD something or other. I'll double check with him, but he's going to go through and make this machine as badass as it can possibly be until Apple decides to finally give us the hot new sexy.
Until they bring the sexy once again. Yes, we must believe that they will bring the sexy. Kelly, what is your pick of the week?
Mine is probably an interesting one, and that is I have this 1 foot Apple charger, Apple Watch charger. It's iPhone certified, or made for, I mean, it's MFI, which I guess also means watch. But it's legit. I got it on Amazon, and the thing that I like about it is that so I don't need it all the time, but I have an original issue Apple Watch. So sometimes if I'm out and about, and like maybe if I had a workout during the day or something, then I can be out and about in the evening and my battery will get low. And so I have my little anchor battery here. I have a little 10,001. It's like deck of cards sized, basically. It's super lightweight. There was another one that I almost bought, but it was way heavier. And so it comes with the little nylon pouch. And so I just drop the Apple Watch cable in here, and then I have a really easy way to charge it. The other nice thing about that is that if I have it, because that lives in my purse all the time. And so if I'm traveling, then I don't have to worry about making sure that I have an Apple Watch cable with me, because I always do. So I can always plug that into my wall charger, or plug it into my battery if I really want to, and make sure that my phone is, or that my watch is 100% when I start the day. So that's what I picked, because it's great to have the super long Apple Watch cable for nightstands and when you have a bunch of tricky wiring to do and stuff. But when I'm traveling, or if I just need to give it enough juice that I can get home and put it on to charge properly or something, then it's really nice to have the much more portable cable. So that's my pick.
Awesome. And my pick of the week, unsurprisingly, is the new $329 iPad. I suppose I have to now call this the iPad Nothing, because I've now got the Apple's site here.
Brand name.
There's the iPad Pro, the iPad Mini 4, and the iPad, new. So I will simply have to call this the iPad Nothing. Because for all the reasons I said before, but the commercial reasons is that the iPad Pro, the 10-inch one, is the cheapest one you can get, is about $650. This one is $329. So you have the choice between getting a 64 gigabyte iPad, 10-inch iPad Pro, or you can get the 9.7-inch $329 one, but also get it upgraded to 128 gigabytes, also get cellular and Wi-Fi, and also have an Apple Pencil for about that same amount of money. And if you don't want an Apple Pencil, you can swap that out for a year of Apple Care and be under the wire. And so, yeah, if I had $650 to spend, I would be, given that the iPad plus the Pencil alone is so much more powerful to me than an iPad Pro and no Pencil, I would be inclined to recommend that. And like I said, I did not ever run into a situation where I felt like I'm running something that's really, really slow and really, really old and really, really can't keep up with the normal stuff that I do when I'm doing 3 or 4 days of business in New York City. So that's it for Mac Break this week. Before we go, though, Kelly Gamont, AppCamp for Girls. Give us your pitch for AppCamp for Girls, because it is collectively, and I'm spring to me, of course, but everybody in this conversation and almost everybody who's listening, who's heard of it, one of our favorite organizations in tech.
Okay. So AppCamp for Girls is day camp, and over the course of a week, we teach girls the basics of iOS development. We take girls, transgender, and gender nonconforming. So going into 8th and 9th grade, and you build a complete app at the end of the week, you pitch your app to a panel of investors. At the end of the summer, we take all of the apps, collect them all into a compendium, and we release that in the App Store for 99 cents. You can actually go purchase any of those now and see the actual apps that were built and designed, and all the artwork for them, all the icons for them. They come, we put all of them in one. And so any developer who attends camp ends up becoming a published developer in the App Store, which is pretty great. And it's been a lot of fun. It started in Portland, Oregon. We're in four cities this year. We're in Portland, Seattle, Chicago, and Minneapolis, which is this is our first year in Minneapolis. It's going to be a lot of fun. I'm going to be there. And it's a really great organization, and the opportunities that it gives the volunteers, as well as the opportunities that it gives the people who attend, it are really, really fantastic. I've made tons of friends. I'm actually learning development. I ended up with a ticket to DubDub this year, so I'm actually going to DubDub as an actual developy person and not just a person who is going to be in the area at the same time that DubDub is happening. There will be an App Camp party on Wednesday night of DubDub week. So we've got ticket information coming out about that soon. So keep an eye on Twitter for that sort of stuff. It's going to be a good time. We always have a lot of fun at the DubDub party, and I would like to see lots and lots of people there. So you should show up if you're going to be in the vicinity. And it sounds like I'm going to see Renee there one way or another. So Andy, I hope you can make it. And The thing about App Camp is that it was a thing that actually started at DubDub, which is part of what's interesting about it, is that our founder, Jean McDonald, realized she was sitting in a room with everybody that was attending DubDub and couldn't see another woman from where she was sitting. And so she set about helping fix that. So that's part of what we're doing. And I'm really excited to be part of that, because it's a concrete action, and it's not one of those hand-wringing blog posts where people go, gosh, what can we do? Like, we're trying to do it. And you know, that's the part that to me is really exciting, is that I am taking active steps and spending time out of my life to make sure that nobody else has to do what I had to do, which was sit in computer class and be the only girl and try to prove that you needed to be there, that it was okay for you to sit in front of the computer and have an interest in technology. And I'm trying to help make that go away, and I feel good about it. So there you go.
Yep, that's just magnificent, magnificent stuff. And so if someone were to be inspired to send App Camp for Girls a big box of money, how could they do that, literally or figuratively?
Well, literally, I guess, would probably be my address, because we don't have delivery at the office. So you probably have to either send it to me or the executive director. But I can make arrangements for that if you do have a box of money laying around and it needs a good home. You can go to appcamp4girls.com and you can contribute to us. We are officially a nonprofit organization. It would be a tax deductible donation. And if you do decide to do that and you go through the form that's scrolling on the page there, you can say that you heard about it from a podcast. And I have heard that it's entirely possible there may be goodies that can show up at your house if you do that. I can't confirm or deny that. But it's definitely a possibility. And say that you heard about it from MacBreak. And consider it. One of my favorite memories actually from App Camp is at the end of last year, one of the parents came up to me and said, I saw you on MacBreak a couple of years ago and my daughter wasn't old enough yet. And App Camp sounded really awesome. And now that she's old enough, she finally got to come. So that was really exciting for me to have been like, that's a very straight line I can draw from. Like, I go on all these podcasts and I go, App Camp is great. You should really know about it. And like, we actually got somebody who showed up in person for the whole week as a result of having done that. So for me, that was very exciting. Like, we get, you know, I know we get some donations and I know that it helps our profile. And Andy, thank you so much for giving me the opportunity to tell more people about it. But that was one that really stood out to me as like, I saw you and I'm waiting for it. Like, I waited for my daughter to be old enough and then she was able to come. And so that was really rewarding.
How does someone get App Camp to come to their city?
You can, well, the first thing you need to do is fill out, there's a contact form on our website, let us know. And then the next thing would be to recruit other people. If you know female developers, or you know people who are event planners or school trip planners or day camp planners or anything like that, or if you have connections to a community, have those people sign up and get in touch with us as well. Because if we get a whole stack of people from a certain place who say, I can help with event space, I can help with snacks. Snacks are important at camp. I can help as a project team lead because I'm an iOS developer and I want to show up. If you are any of those people, like there's a whole list of the positions that we need, and we need those in every city. So if you can find some of those people and encourage them to fill out the contact form on our site, we would be able to start looking at that as a possible place for a new location. We want to build App Camp everywhere that everybody wants to have it. So if you are one of those people, let us know and we'll see what we can do to expand.
Have you thought about doing it online?
We're exploring that now, as far as like logistically what that would take, because there's still a certain amount of in person in a room that is important with it. But we're looking at it and we're going to see, we will probably test it on a small scale, like locally, probably with a Portland camp, and then see where we can go from there.
Sounds good.
Well, Renee, how are you changing children's lives in a positive way in a society that doesn't always elevate them to the status they want?
I'm sorry, every time I hear
someone who's doing something as cool as what Kelly is doing, I'm like, well, I'm not going to follow that. Let's see what Renee has to say. What's going on in iMore?
I'm just giving Kelly Gaumont and Jean and everybody all my money so that they can do wonderful works, and I can feel less terrible about not giving them all my money.
But Renee, what about your watch band habit?
Oh yeah, maybe I can get a small stipend back to feed my watch band. No, I have a new video up.
And I'll send you a watch band.
Okay, let's do it. Deal. Okay. App Camp for Girls watch band. Oh my God, it's a killer idea. I got a new video up. George Adele very kindly read me all of the internet's questions, and I did my best to answer them. And other than that, we're going to hit Apple earnings real hard in about 15 minutes.
I bet you have to run, so perhaps we should let you end your part on a shot of your chair just like spinning empty with a cloud shaped vaguely like Renee in the place where you once were. Alex Lindsay of Pixel Core, what would you like to deny that you're doing in the next 2 or 3 days by cagily saying, I might be in this city doing this sort of thing?
I'm definitely not going to be in New York at the end of the week.
So, okay. So earlier today you went for the double bluff by saying that you might be. Okay.
No, yeah. So hopefully I'll get some time to. I'm going to try to get some time to at least see if people are around. But I'm not sure. It's oftentimes when I come in, it's in and out. But that's where I'm going. Otherwise, I'm just on Twitter mostly complaining about NPR.
Again, you know, exactly. They don't the muffins they've got in the waiting area. I mean, they call it a triple berry muffin, but mine had cranberries and blueberries. What was the third berry? I don't know. Some of the extra cranberries.
Well, just imagine if they took away your muffins. That's you know, and fed them to the dog that they took away from me.
Clearly, it was a nothing berry.
I'll tell you, when I was at the NPR studios in New York, not only did they not take them away, they didn't check my bag to see how many that I'd packed in my bag left. But let's not talk about that. I am Andy Iannocco, a veteran tech pundit. I still need to come up with a good tagline on what I do for a living. One of the nice things about writing for the Sun-Times is that you say, Andy Iannocco, tech columnist of the Chicago Sun-Times. Okay, I get what you do. We actually, at NPR, we had to talk about, well, how should I describe you then? I said, well, I'm not unemployed. I'm just, you know, working for myself now. So if you want to find out what's up with me, what I'm writing, what I'm publishing, what I'm doing, spell my last name, go to iannocco.com for my blog. Iannocco on Instagram, Iannocco on Twitter, Iannocco in your hearts and on your minds, I hope. That's it for Mac Break Weekly this week. Thank you for listening this time. Hope you listen to us again next time. Till then, break time's over. Get back to work, you cult fricks. Off of Facebook, and I'm paying you to Facebook. Unless you work at Facebook, which you are probably being paid to Facebook. So thanks for taking like an hour and a half off of your Facebooking time in order to listen to us. Anyway, toodles.
Look at this. Heavier and better keyboard. There we go. See?